Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show. Sometimes when we cover a topic, it just passes by like water under the bridge, and we never really hear about that much again. But other times, the topic stays relevant. So we've got a few bits and pieces from the last season that are worth looking at again.
We really need to do the Online Safety Act. Pornhub, since July, due to the Online Safety Act, and they're all going to illegal websites instead. Today, have announced that they've got a drop in the UK by 77% compared to July due to the Online Safety Act, and that they are all going to other sites that are ignoring the requirements. People don't want to be tracked while they're looking at pornography, but they have always been tracked. If you want to have an untracked wank, there is a magazine store, because when you sign up to those websites, if you didn't read the T's and C's, it clearly said it was going to API you to fuck and sell it to anyone. And that's where you have personalised ads, where you're trying to have a wank. When you're finished, do you want to get a pizza, mate? Honestly, that's...
I don't know. Okay, so it's a side effect, really, isn't it? Is it driving people onto dark web things that they need right. to do to not be tracked? Because obviously there's a market for not being tracked wankers, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So those guys going somewhere else. So that's possibly a backlash effect on online safety bill, but not one that couldn't have been foreseen.
And and that's the point, is that we did foresee this. We did know that the sites that are going to be big enough that have to implement it are going to have that problem, where they're going to have a huge drop, and then all these little other sites that don't give a shit about it will come up. But we were supposed to have a regulatory system that would find them and fine them.
Certain policies just invite totalitarian escalation, don't they? It's like when you make a massive ultimatum, and however ridiculous it is, you feel like you've got to back yourself up.
How do you control that situation? Well, you could try and potentially say, well, okay, so if you're not compliant to the Online Safety Act and you are causing harms, we will stop your access from the UK to your website. But you're right, they're just, as we said before, they're just going to the dark web, and all we're really doing is shoving people into the worst place possible to hide their identity. What we need is government actually to be really open about what the Online Safety Act verification process is, and to actually say, look, we don't give a shit what you're doing.
If you're going to create something in defence of legitimate sanitised porn supply, which is it's not an unheard of policy, because like you think of giving needles, the Dutch government were way ahead on legalising prostitution and just making sure it was run really well. I mean, there is good humanist arguments for a well-regulated sex industry, etc. So if you want to kind of stick a flag in the ground for wholesome porn, there's good arguments to be made for making it so that it's anonymous.
Yeah.
Helping the anonymity, because clearly that's what people want.
Yeah.
Porn could come out as the shining example of that industry where you can browse what you want and nobody knows who you are.
Well, there's a new business venture. There you go.
Yeah.
Totally compliant. But the government needs to, and the websites need to be like, yeah, we've got to take your ID and verify you, but we're deleting it. Just running the checks. I mean, they don't want to hold all that data anyway. They're going to bin it. And there needs to be another way of age identifying someone that doesn't mean they have to submit their government ID.
You could use zero knowledge proofs. They work. They do work. And so you can verify an attribute of somebody who's a holder of a certificate without knowing either what that certificate is, its identity, or anything else about them. It's really clever, zero knowledge proofs, yeah? There's a whole overlap of good uses of that sort of technology that might help with that problem. But yeah, I think demanding people's identity for browsing porn is not going to work.
Everyone's freaking out on Facebook. Oh, the government wants to track my porn. And I'm like, but you order the internet to your house and you pay for it every month on a credit card. So they already know what the fuck you're doing. I'm trying to give them the heads
most
up.
Most people don't.
That if they get a VPN,
yeah,
no one will know what they're doing. I'm like, yeah, but your internet service providers don't know where you're going.
Your internet service provider don't know where you're going if you've got a proper tunnel in the VPN. No, they don't.
Yeah, all the commercial home new VPNs have a back door into them.
Don't tell me you've been prying into my private affairs.
It's self-evident, surely.
That's a terrible failure of that product, isn't it? That's awful. Yeah. And not people knew how badly VPNs were implemented and what their security was like,
because they
wouldn't buy them. But then they would move on to other ones that do work. ISPs have never had any hope of being in a policing role.
No, but they just give the data to whoever asks for it.
They do, as an expediency of business. And so they've kind of got trapped into that. But relying on ISPs to tittle-tattle is a foolish idea, really.
Yeah, but it's just the fact that people think it's secret. And so obviously we know that, like, it's not that secret, me.
Do you know what? I mean, just to cut that as a philosophical argument, it's a poor challenge to people because it's a bit like saying, you found out that I've been robbing you. I've been nicking money out of the till. Mate, I've been doing it for years.
Yes.
You know, the fact that you've been doing it for years is not an argument for the fact that you're doing it. Yeah.
No.
you're such a mug. You should have realized years ago I was having the money out of the till. It doesn't, I guess that doesn't help people adjust.
No, and it's not working. So the whole point of the Online Safety Act is, again, it's not worked, is it? Because we're trying to stop children looking at porn. And now instead of going to the safe and secure porn hub, which doesn't contain illegal pornography, they're now going to sites that do contain illegal pornography and don't give shit if you're 12.
Sure, but hold on. And it has worked. It's had impacts, right?
Yeah, it has.
I mean, the fact that a lot of this stuff is visible and talked about is a huge achievement.
That's true. And one of the things that I've heard people say is when someone's like, oh, I'm so sick of the government wanting to spy on me. And I've heard a man turn around and go, it's nothing to do with that. It's to stop a 9-year-old accessing hardcore porn. I don't want children watching porn. Do you? And that person's now got nowhere to climb. They're like, oh, well, no, I don't want kids looking at pornography. And I do understand that. But, you know, I'm a bit annoyed. It's like, yeah, but there has to be a solution, right? And at the moment, this is the one we've got. A lot of the people, that's their opinion. That's good. The other half of it is you think that the government generally are really interested in what pornography they're watching.
So you're saying there's not a lot of sensible talk and debate about
that? It's like all this like crazy conspiracy shit. It's a Big Brother situation. I'm like,
I think that's a natural response to being surveilled.
I think that like the fact that people just went, oh, this is just a mass surveillance program. It's not for kids at all.
Good. I mean, we're here to challenge lazy thinking, aren't we?
We can expect a crime wave.
Over last summer in the UK, we had a lot of incidents involving very large public organisations and large public spaces and venues. We've seen a recurrent security anti-pattern going on where they want to get a lot of throughput and so bring in lots of technology to manage crowds. But then that technology is either not very good or it works for a while and then it fails. And that actually leads to a much worse security situation than if they'd just employed a few people to deal with it all manually. So a really good way to keep an airport fairly empty while making a lot of money is to hugely increase the throughput so that people aren't hanging around, they're just moving through. But if you implement security measures that create massive queues and huge crowds of people milling around and sitting down, well, that's obviously a big target. And kind of worse, by forcing us to adopt draconian security measures, there's a kind of effect of sapping and attrition on the economy, on people's wealth, health and happiness. So we have to wonder, you know, are these technological security measures really cost effective at all? Yeah, how was Fort Park then? It's like basically a day of queuing up.
Oh, mate, we were there for like 10 hours and we had to queue up for an hour and a half to get in because of the new venue laws. Yeah. So they have to go through and check for bombs in everyone's pockets and bags.
Well, they do like have an airport baggage scanner set up.
Yeah, and then they frisk you and go over everything. And you have to go through all the bags as well. So it's quite a lot of airport security, but it's really slow. It's not as fast as airport security. So we queued up for an hour and a half to get in.
That's going to break that business, isn't it? Who wants to do that?
I know, right? And then we queued up for 2 hours for every ride. So I think we went on 5 rides in like 10 hours. So yeah, it was pretty shit. The kids had a great time.
I hate this. I hate Fort Park. Yeah. Fort Park sucks. And then we get to the end of the day and go, did you have a good day? And they're like, yeah.
Best day ever. Best day.
My back. Face gone retro with Commodore 64.
Oh, nice.
This is how computers are supposed to be. I think they know instinctively, even if they've never seen an analog gaming console before, it's like, this is how computers are meant to be, isn't it? It's like, yeah, you just switch it on and boom, you're playing Space Invaders and Tekken and Street Fighter. She's gone completely crazy for Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, basically every single two-player fighting game. She's mad about it.
That's awesome. I used to love those games when I was a kid. Microsoft had a complete fail with two big game releases coming out that people had pre-installed. It went down at 4 o'clock and didn't come back up worldwide until about 8, 9 o'clock at night.
That's sad, isn't it? A lot of disappointed kids.
Oh, DNF server was down. And what surprised me is the Steam Deck, which is supposed to be Linux-based, completely was unavailable throughout that period, which is meant to be a Linux gaming option, but it's still using Windows. And it was like all the banks went down because obviously 365 is gone, so the bank can't perform their job.
Microsoft are having a very bad time of it lately, and its scale at which they're trying to do stuff means it's dinosaur time. You know, they fail because of their size. Big tech is failing because it can't survive at that scale.
No, it's
a natural selection. So even like with the total failure of governments to regulate for like what, the last 30 years or something, just step aside and realize, okay, yeah, you can let things grow, but they grow to a certain size and then they don't work anymore.
No, and they get fascist. That's a natural part of their nature as well, because they accidentally have that control. So they'll use it. East India Empire.
Oh, yeah, the East India Tea Company.
Yeah, became its own empire, for fuck's sake, and then was like holding government over the barrel by going, well, I've got more money than you, so I can do what I want. And what happened? The company collapsed, so it caused chaos. We lost India. It's a big deal.
For an old proverb, it's too many eggs in one basket. And however you plan and organise things, you put too many things dependent in one place. We spoke to Rob Demain about the impact of security incidents at Heathrow Airport.
The impact to Heathrow was the fact that it was a supplier of the software that got compromised. And it affected people like Dublin and various other airports. And it was a data theft, so they compromised some creds, stole all the passenger data, and then a subsequent ransomware took down the availability at the supplier end, and that meant that the airports that used that software couldn't use the automated check-in terminals. So that's one. Second was the point around how well airports cope with this in general, and the avian industry is perfect for handling crisis, whether it's a volcano spewing ashes around. So it's a really good example of, you know, sometimes you do need a manual process, which leads you into the NCSC's annual report and the messaging they're putting out, which is, you know, these things are going to happen. We need to have backup plans that are actually workable. Example of that.
Co-op is a really good example of that as well, because they reverted back to paper and pen, which is how they managed to keep operating where others didn't.
Completely. And I think the other kind of message around it is, I've got, you know, would this organisation be in scope for the CAF and the CAA? Would this be scoped by it? And if so, would it have been effective if it was? There's so many regulations and guidelines, but they are really guidelines, and they're open to interpretation, should we say. I don't think they're specific enough around actually dealing with the problem. So it'll say you've got to have an instant response plan and test it. It doesn't say you should be able to restore services in an hour.
No, right? I know exactly what you mean. It will say, oh, you need to make sure that you do pen testing, regular pen testing. Well, some company will just run a tool once a year and say that's regular pen testing, whereas others will have a whole team doing it every single day, and they'll both be able to tick the same box. That's not the same job.
Yeah. And that's not going to cut it against the type of threat we're facing. And it doesn't demonstrate cyber resilience, which is the key point. And I guess the kind of underlying point for me is that, does all these checkboxes make you cyber resilient? Don't think so. I can't disagree with what they say, but I don't think I don't think it's achieving the objectives.
That's a deep topic, the reality gap. What is the role of regulation and compliance and metrics and things in a very complex reality of cybersecurity? It's a part. A lot of training is a part. You know, regulation is a part. There's lots of different components. But the resilience, I think, is very, very important from a social point of view. Resilience is really the because we can't make systems work and we can't make them reliable, not depending on them too much and having kind of alternatives built in is a design choice. And that's something that I'd like to keep focusing on, is these successes. So Helen, if you want to bring up Co-op again, you know, and also I do want to sort of big up Heathrow a little bit, because it's no point just pouring doom and gloom on a multi-crisis, because you don't know where to even look. The thing
that's
is like
part of the problem as well, isn't it? Is that the damage to reputation happened to Heathrow, but they were just using a third party in an area where there's lack of choice. I mean, how many baggage software handler
Absolutely. I mean, to ascribe responsibility to Heathrow in, or the aviation authority, or in any organisation in any way, it becomes ridiculous, because attribution makes no sense anymore in such a complex and very dependent system. So what I wanted to say by way of praise is, look, it wasn't catastrophic. All of the backup processes worked. People got their pens and paper out, and they remember how to check things in manually. And, you know, and it works. It's just a bit slower than when you've got the digital systems. It actually highlights the value that those systems are adding. And you can, maybe it's time to make a more informed cost-benefit analysis of, like, over-complexity.
That is going to cause more of these problems. It's the inherent complexity of the multiple supply chains and the software they're using, and the interdependencies on things. Major cloud providers being dependent on sort of old bits of the internet, like DNS. And the kind of the way they complicate that with the modern systems does create a lot of, you know, a lot of problems that have been there a long time can have the same impact they've always had. Complexity point huge. And that's going to be a problem moving forward, because a lot of digitization is taking place. Everyone wants to digitize to save money so they can scale. But actually, that does create complexity. And complexity means that things take a lot longer to fix.
Part of that issue with complexity as well is using third parties and not doing things in-house anymore. You know, I think it's become really, really common for someone to say, oh, we need something doing. Let's look about and see what we can find, rather than have we got somebody in our employee that can do that job for us so that it belongs to us, and then we're in control of that and we don't have those supply chain issues as much. I think that we're in a stage at the moment where we just outsource rather than in-house work.
Because in things like air traffic control, they'd never outsource air traffic controllers, would they?
No.
That's kind of the cure is where they understand the risk is so high that they must insource and train and have huge programs and huge costs. But I guess on the perimeter like this, it's more cost effective, isn't it? You know, theoretically, to outsource this to someone who should be a trusted name in this area. But I guess that's where the compliance thing comes in, is are you really checking that they're doing the right thing on your behalf? So if you are going to outsource, are you in control of it?
That's an absolute key point. That's really, really spot on, Rob. You know, you can't outsource trust. Trust is a different orthogonal currency to dollars and pounds and money. To some extent, you can buy trust. And in that sense, the political and financial spheres don't intersect. It actually doesn't work there. Letting the Chinese build a nuclear power plant for us at Hinkley Point wasn't necessarily a smart defense move, you know, especially one that's network controlled from Beijing. And so anyway, it's irrelevant how that discussion went, but the point that it raised is that these economics that we use to justify lots of decisions, they have to stand the test of other realities, other worlds. And when they do, this is where you see the failures. It's because it works fine on paper, yeah, according to money. It doesn't work so well technically or socially or so on. Yeah.
Well, that's, if you look at other cyber attacks impact with the suppliers for things like M&S and JLR, and I'm sure that economically the outsourcing contracts made a lot of sense until this happens. Because the impact of the cost of the cyber attack is probably a lot more than the savings of the outsourcing. I guess that's maybe a lesson people should learn there, that, you know, ultimately the loss of control there has cost them $1.9 billion. And that's a lot more than the savings were for the actual contract that they outsourced.
We had to make a style sheet for a web page, and Helen and I are both rubbish at doing CSS style sheets. And once upon a time, you could just go on Stack Exchange and look at a tutorial or something, but ChatGPT's kind of killed Stack Exchange. And it's getting harder and harder to find decent online tutorials for things. Anyway, Helen thought she'd use ChatGPT to make the style sheet, and that opened a whole can of worms.
I'm going to do the AI and then make it look all right and then send it over to you, and then you can just do whatever you feel you need to do with it to save us like hours and hours of time.
It would save hours and hours of time if we do it right. It could create hours and hours of time if we do it wrong. Just do it once for that one page and get the style exactly how you like.
That's what
I'm
going to do.
Give me that with the embedded style sheet, and then after that, only do it in text.
But again, I'm not putting any of our text in. Or
all
any
we want
of our
is a style sheet. All I want is a style sheet.
Awesome. Well, what I was going to do is create the page, get the style sheet all done, and then I can create a text and say, here's the style sheet with all like the bullshit text it generated for us. And then I was going to create my own code in VHC, which I can upload to the file, which will literally have all of the wording that we want in it, basically, so it looks how we want it to look.
Yeah, the wording, the content, is to be completely separate from the style. That's how we have to do it.
Yeah, that's what I'm very doing. Pretty. That is literally what I'm doing. I am not letting Microsoft touch that. It is in VSC code, but I haven't even put it on. I've got a separate PDF with our text on, so that when we've got it locally, we can then put the text on before we make it live, so that ChatGPT does not look at anything that I have created.
Well, it's not like super confidential content.
No, I know, but I don't. I constantly tell people that you shouldn't be putting this shit in there because it's public. So what it might do is trigger someone who's watching this and scraping this to go, oh, that's a really good idea.
Well, yeah, no, what you're saying is absolutely sound, but the whole issue of digital privilege, if you think about, like, for the last, 20 years more, Google is party to everybody's search queries and their email pretty much. And that always going to give you a competitive advantage to know what everybody else is doing. So in business, using these tools is just really, really foolish. You know, you're handing over money to a couple of corporations. You're handing over ideas, like you're handing over all sorts of stuff that you don't.
Yeah, but also with ChatGPT, every time that you use it, it publicly shows all of your results to a public forum that anybody can access, including personal data that people have been putting in, like really personal stuff, and people have been finding it because it's publicly searchable.
Well, it sounds like an art project and like radical openness. It sounds like sort of Josh Harris type commune or something. I don't know, but like, yeah, I mean, maybe that could, that's a bit Californian. Maybe that could do something. Like everything you put in it just gets published to everybody.
Yeah, literally.
So I don't know, but yeah, I would be very cautious. I'd be very boundaried about what I use that for. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to be like, just produce me this like basic design that everybody else sort of has on their website. Thank you very much.
We spent a bit of time around Christmas reviewing the reach and impact of what we do with the Cyber Show, thinking about our message and who that might be reaching. Are the people that we meet and talk to in real life also the people who listen to us online? Naturally, we expect big tech companies like Microsoft and Google and Facebook to censor or at least mute our message because we're very opposed to what they do. But there remains a question of why the public isn't more generally and openly debating these kinds of issues and what more we can do to promote digital literacy.
Could be one.
Well, I mean, there's the politics and there's the policy and there's like, you know, there's making recommendations and there's, you know, the thing about it is just, you're going to spearhead something. You have to be visionary and you have to make guesses about what's going bad and what's going well. And so the question of like, when we do a course and it's universalized for everybody, you know, when you add that on the end, it's for everybody.
Yeah, for all courses.
Have a deep think about that. Is it really? You know, because there's always these qualifiers that are tagging on very quickly, you know. It's for everybody who's thinking of progressing into higher education. It's for everybody.
Yeah, it's for people going into office or computer-based roles. It's not for your bricklayer or your mechanic. Well, actually, the mechanics and bricklayers do need to use computers now, actually, and they do need cybersecurity.
But we've had it. We've had it, done it, seen it, nicked it, got the T-shirt, didn't work. What we call projects of digital literacy. When they happen, do they really work? And what happened in the earlier mid-90s? Digital literacy education just tailed off and it went into this neverland of teaching people Microsoft Office thing because that's what they need to know.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like Amanda's going, okay, well, you come and do another couple of shows for me. You can do your digital literacy that you've made a good pitch about.
That's nice. That's an opportunity. But I am very wary of getting close to political parties in general.
I know.
And I think it's inevitable that we get involved with political parties because what I'd like to do, a big interview where we just get like 4 or 5 of the main parties in.
Well, she said yes. And I know that you've already got Daniel. So we've now got 2. I've got to send her an email this week.
It's going to be difficult. I think it's going to be like, it leads to a lot of long email chains. And I quite like it if it was in the open. So I think rather than trying to organise any sort of shroud around that conversation is to just use open emails. And if people can't be reached or they make themselves unreachable, they're excluding themselves from the conversation. And I think it would make 2 or 3 really good episodes. And
it would. I know that. I know that. Yeah. And she is going to send us somebody who actually does that at the moment in government. And I think once they're in the email chain, you'll be surprised, you know, how many will go, well, hang on, I'm not having that opportunity go away. So that has come out of it as a result of it. And it is good to be able to call up the government. It would have been nice if we could have worked with the old government as well, but that was never going to happen. They're insane. So
don't write anyone off in the margins, but like,
no,
history or whatever, you know. But
no, I know. They just change leader every 5 minutes and they change the team every 5 minutes. So even if we had somebody on, they wouldn't know what the fuck they were talking about because their job changed last week. That's what I meant.
But yeah, political parties are weak, but they're meant to be weak.
Yeah, but they represent the system. And I guess what we need to start including in our podcast, if we're going to truly represent citizens, is the voice and the critique of the government, because we're well up for critiquing it, but we don't really give them the opportunity to talk.
What, you mean like Labour? You're talking about because they're in now?
It doesn't matter who's in. It could be the fucking spaghetti party for all I care. What's your opinion on digital?
It does matter to pay attention to who's the opposition and who's in government when you're interviewing them. It really does.
Exactly, and to have all those in. But what I'm saying is I'm not sure whether I don't know if it's like party affiliation, or what I'd say is that we just have a government now that actually listen to the general public a bit more, and you're able to engage with them a bit more. And they're not the only party that are engageable and approachable, because Lib Dems and Green are also engageable and approachable. So I think we can generally start including lots of political parties at this point. But I mean, the way I see it is they are my local government, and it's Portsmouth Council that seem more interested in the work that we can do, and they need that work here specifically. And so they're like, look, you're good. What can we do? And I feel like that's really interesting. And that's what she said to me last time, is they want to improve Portsmouth, make jobs, get people educated better. Men's mental health, particularly in the online sphere, which we obviously cover on the show quite a lot, especially with Kate, and we have been asked to get involved with that in government, who are taking roles of that type in government at the moment, and they would potentially need people to actually come and talk about the digital side of it, and also potentially the psychology digital side of it, which we're literally covering. Men's mental health that relates to a lot of online activity that we are very well versed in, and also had a lovely conversation about in Cambridge as well. And I think what they like about us is that people are already listening, so it's like, hey, look, you know those people that some of you listen to, they're right here and they're going to say something very important right now.
Coincidentally, Jerry McGovern's
yes
said he's written a book, and would I review it, and it's 600 pages. Jeez. And it's,
we're all gonna die next week.
Yeah, kind of. It's like technological catastrophe book. Okay. And its connection with the male ego.
If there's anything more important than my ego around here, I want it caught and shot now.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So it got me thinking, and I said, because you wanted me to review it, and I had mixed feelings, and I felt uncomfortable, but I really want to review it for some reasons. I'm sure there's lots of ideas in it I'm really going to like. I don't know if I can take that much doom again at the moment. but, you know, I thought the only way I can do it is to kind of take a different step, to be, you know, write very critically. So I'll give you a review, but be really critical. I'm going to stand up for the boys in this one, you know, because that's sort of not happening. I don't think anyone's really understood what incel culture is.
No. Or what modern masculinity looks like. There's no real guidelines for young men on what that looks like. There's just the past, and that's not acceptable. Yeah. And it's really difficult for young boys to find role models that are acceptable. What should they be doing now? Where do you find them?
And need it, and they need it. And
yeah, they do need it.
Other responsible, insightful adults around them at their critical ages to tell them what they should be doing in life and where they can be going and what the choices are and what the consequences are and all that. It's just not happening anymore. Boys, all the boys are lost now. It's really scary. Like, have a load of lost boys.
Especially white boys, because they never really had to compete, I guess, as much. And now they do. There's women working harder than them and outscoring them. But also people who come from minority backgrounds in the UK are working harder and therefore getting ahead. White boys that are just giving up and falling behind. And the education levels are quite shocking at this point.
Well, it sounds like a lot of symptoms and not a statement of a cause. Looking deeper, it's like life is competitive. Like, life's to be engaged with. Life is to be able to, you know, seize the day is to be seized. Well, it's part of human spirit. But it's there in boys in spades when they're young, and they just need visions and things to do and things to be hopeful about. And
it's
not happening for them. It's really sad.
And it's really sad.
The question is, has technology done that? you know, and that's a big question, because yes, it has, but it needn't have. And I think that really kind of what's been done and what's happening is part of a much bigger picture.
It is. Like, I mean,
we're just not seeing really yet.
In the last year alone, 33% of all entry plate level jobs in this country have disappeared due to AI. So there's that massive lack of hope, isn't there? It's like, even if you go and get the education now, so out your ear holes, might not get a job because there's somebody older than you with more experience and the computer's replacing your... I've just proved that today. I could have used an entry-level coder to do my style sheet. Nope, they cost money.
There's a lot to be scared of.
Yeah.
But why are people fixating on that fear? Every single thing is an opportunity and a thing to be played with, to discover, to make a new idea. It's a wild frontier
of
possibility, and it's fun as well, as it was for the game, as for all the game coders.
I have fun today with the AI. I'm not even kidding. I'm like, oh, this feels new. Because I literally had that today. How much can I push this technology to do what I want it to do?
The pleasure that you get wears out, and then we have to do it again and again. So the technology kind of becomes a drug that way. A different way of positively relating to technology for boys. One of them is to be creative, and one is to be destructive.
Yeah.
A computer as a tool does both of those things. And it's a toy for exploring life. But how limited that universe is, and there's an outside, there's a park, there's a community, there's places to go and people to see, you know.
I was going to say, we've got some shows that have been requested, which are all really good, actually. So one of them is that we do social media and the rise of the algorithm. And I've been putting Facebook through its paces this week because there's some, like, dear old mums with disabled children just sharing content that says, let's set fire to people in buildings. It's got pretty Nazi, actually. And then you report it to Facebook and they're supposed to remove some of this stuff. I've literally got a post that says, none of this goes against our community standards. However, it does go against inciting right-wing terrorism laws in the UK and definitely goes along the Online Safety Act. I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to break the law in my country. This is the issue that we've got, isn't it? Is that they used to do it. They fired their team when Trump got in. And so now what we're seeing is our laws and systems are just being thrown away and disregarded because they're under the rule whoever pays the bill of Facebook is now in control. And that can change, and that can change for any technology overnight, depending on where it's based.
Yeah, the tech is a completely different axis of power. And a lot of people just haven't noticed that, but yeah, it is. And so, like, the ability to control what's seen, what's not seen, who gets to shout at who, how loud they get to shout, what the effects of that are. The more laws you throw into that, the more you just turn it into a spectacle, a courtroom, and an information war to try and use the law to take down each other's points of view. And that's going nowhere. That's going to exhaust everyone's energy and patience. I think that will kill social media. I think that was the end of it.
But it just seems to be used as like a tool for the angry right now.
It's a tool for angry people.
Yeah. And people who weren't angry are now suddenly angry. It's like, well, you were fine before. Like, this lady got a disabled kid and I met her through Mel. And she was just this lovely lady. As living in a cancer flat, she got a really disabled kid. And now she's suddenly like really angry and sharing all this mad shit. Well, she wasn't angry before. She was just disappointed that she didn't get the help she needs. But now she's angry at like immigrants. I don't know who told her that her son hasn't got stuff because there's a brown man over there. But somebody did. And now she believes it so wholeheartedly. She's gone full Nazi. Like, I'd literally... She could just punch someone in the face for no reason, and she'd never have done that last year. She's become extremist. Mm. Quite scary, and Facebook is definitely a part of that.
I don't think the government can control people's views that they express on social media.
No, I'm not saying that they should, but I'm saying that Facebook used to have a rule that says if you're inciting violence, in other words, go, yeah, let's meet up at this time and burn that house down and beat the shit out of them. Facebook could say, I'm so sorry, but this goes against our community standards. You are using our platform to essentially arrange a crime, and we don't want to be held sort of somehow responsible legally. So we're shutting down your communication in that subject area, and we advise that you don't do that again, or we'll have to remove you from the platform. Like, we're not shutting you down from having that conversation. They're just like, can you not do that smut on my platform, please?
It's perfectly reasonable, but it didn't work, and it's not working, is it? That capability doesn't work out.
Well, I mean, if you use this AI that they're using to scrape everyone's data, then I'm pretty sure that the machine could. Well, it's supposed to. It did it to us. It screened out our shit.
I'm not saying it doesn't work out because its detection's ineffectual.
Yeah, it doesn't work out
as a mechanism because it becomes part of the problem. It becomes seized upon by the parties in conflict.
You know, they use that
as a, yeah, All moderation techniques tend to get hijacked
Yeah, they do.
And the more usable you make them, the more they get hijacked and become part of another political football on the field.
Yeah. So maybe the result of that, which is what I'm trying to say, is that we need to, you know, the EU or your country need to start maybe doing some of that moderation if it's affecting your society. Seems like a fair, annoying
comment. And there are different places don't intervene by messing around with the algorithms, the Facebooks and the Googles and whatever. They need to restructure how tech is, how you can use tech, actually.
Yes, delivered, how it's delivered. That's
and who delivers it? And it's really important. And like, you know, we're in an era of sanctions.
Right, layer 7, the presentation. That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, we can take the algorithm. And then at the presentation there, can we not just tweak that a bit? That's what I'm thinking.
Inject their own material and use it as a surveillance point.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you should do that at all.
But governments want to do things like that, right?
I know they do. I don't think the government has the ability to run that system, my friend.
I heard a really good phrase this week, which was from C.S. Lewis, I think. Politics without policy and policy without politics are really common things. Politics without policy.
Yeah.
We're really unhappy and we want shit to change, but we don't really have a clue. And you can have stuff that's the other way around. Digital ID cards and technocracy is policy without politics.
Right.
Both of those things are rubbish. Yeah. Having governments and running affairs and bit, you know, of state of the world, of running things, they're just shit ways to do it. Yeah. Politics and policy have to go together, and then one has to generate the other and things like that.
Because there's no actual plan behind this, right? That's the point. There's no plan behind it. It was just like, oh, we got to placate the right, so we'll just come out with something where we say we track people coming
in. I think there was a plan. There's a vague idea. There's a strong emotional idea. There's a strong instinct. And that's what happens in politics, right? There's a strong emotional instinct to do something about something, right? But it's an ass-scratching kind of what specifically, what exactly, and how's that going to work with everything else, you know, in a system? There's none of that thinking going on. System's thinking. And the problem is that on the other side, the engineers are so cut off. What the engineers are doing, trying to implement completely harebrained shit, building it ground up with no clear vision of what positive technology looks like for a modern society. There's no vision of that.
We've lost vision. You know, this is why I go back to Yanis Varoufakis.
I like that dude. He's a cool dude.
I want him on our show. I saw him on another podcast, and like the podcast is a bit shit, but I mean, he's a good presenter, BBC style, you know, boring.
When we did that thing in London for the SMPTE, he's one of the slides in the background.
I know.
Yeah. He already has been on our show.
I know, but I want him as a guest. Yeah. Can we just start sending him messages?
I'm telling you, we had you on our show before, Dennis. Would you like to come back again?
In person this time.
You might forget and just go, yeah, shit, I remember those guys. Yeah.
But no, he said something really interesting, and that was that we had a direction, you know, to some extent, we came out of World War II, colonialism came down, we had this way, we tried this. Then we tried the left, that doesn't work. And we've just tried like globalization left, that hasn't worked. And so what now happens is the right go, oh, we've got the answer, which always happens when one side fails, the other side will say, oh, come to our side, and things get more extreme. And then he actually...
I missed the end of that. It was really good. You were telling me so. And then that stupid screen went off again. This is the problem, isn't it? I got eco-conscious. I've greenwashed myself, yeah?
Yes,
And I set loads of my CPUs down onto, like, just more energy-efficient settings. Uh-oh. I set loads of screens to switch off earlier, and I put loads more hibernates on the boxes. And now I keep having to get out of my fucking chair to go over there and wiggle the mouse.
You're using your legs instead of the environment. I like it. Human environment.
No, I left it so long. Now I got to type the password in.
The green question on that is, does if we added up how much extra calories you're burning and therefore need to consume by getting up and pressing the buttons, does that outweigh the M&S chief of technology has just left his position, less than a year after their huge cyber attack, which is less than useful.
M&S?
Their chief of technology has just left his post. He's resigned. And obviously, they're still recovering from that huge cyber attack. So having to come in to that position during the process of recovery is going to be difficult anyway. But obviously, he took a lot of that knowledge and information with him.
I guess part of that conversation was about the etiquette of what to do in that position. Was it ethical to leave a company that kind of needs you? I guess that's why I got into the news. It was more a case of how could you abandon the ship when it's at a time in the
room? No, that's so unfair. The poor guy.
It is unfair.
He's probably left for health reasons. He's probably.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You know, he's been battered by the whole thing. And
they might have had to move home, like, to look after an elderly person. You just don't know. You can't assume that he's just jumped ship.
No, that's a really unfair accusation and speculation. Where was the support? Where were the other 10 people that they brought in to help him? You know, that's what I would be asking.
There we go. What other news we've got?
I'd love, in a way, to be able to move the whole conversation onwards and above and beyond these individual, Land Rover got hammered, Marks and Spencer got hammered. And in a way, they've sort of become uninteresting because it's like other people's dirty laundry. I feel really sad for them. I feel really sorry for them. It's an absolute crying tragedy that we don't have the cybersecurity education and we don't have the defensive posture and that the whole thing is screwed from top to bottom. But the conversation has to kind of go on to the fact that this is systemic. It's structural. There's no point in just talking about this company or that company. Everyone's in the same boat and we're all facing exactly the same problems, and nobody has got the bollocks to talk about what those problems are, because they are, well, at least until very, very recently, they've been inconvenient truths that nobody wants to say. And they are that basically the whole tech stack and most of this stuff that's come from the US is absolute dog shit.
I think a lot of people are catching up with that idea.
It doesn't matter what policies you're following, what your CISOs are doing, what monitoring you're doing on the firewall. If you're running Microsoft, if you're running this cookie cutter off the shelf, wipes your ass for you, software suites, you're in big trouble.
Right. Which most people are actually running, because there's an education issue in this country where the children are just taught how to use that product. It's getting better. There is more code in there. But, you know, my kids are like, what's Linux? Oh, it's the other operating system that runs the world. Well, I never heard of that. Well, you should have done. But they know what a Raspberry Pi is. Yeah, they know what a Raspberry Pi is because you can use it for gaming and like storing stuff. And I'm like, well, it's way more useful than that. Should see what I can do with it.
I looked into the digital ID passes, so they have not been cancelled. Check the research on it, but it was from like Beeping Computer. It was a really good show. And they said that it hasn't been cancelled. They looked into all the vulnerabilities of the systems that they're going to be using. So these are two, one of the companies is American and one's British, and they will be doing the ID checks. They also signed up with essentially advertising agencies. So the UK government are going to get paid every single time that you check a land, you know, you get a new property or you do a check of any kind. They will sell all that details to multiple agencies. And one of these is an American fucking agency that has 92 vulnerabilities on its database.
The whole thing sounds like a stinking political nightmare.
It is really corrupt. And the NCSC actually wrote a letter that said, this is the most dangerous thing to national security and cybersecurity you could have proposed, which is essentially why they pulled out. But the government hasn't stopped it. What it said is, find a way to fix the vulnerabilities. But it's something like 247 vulnerabilities across the board.
Okay, it's corruption. Does it even belong on a tech show? Because if it's naked political corruption, all there is to talk about is the IT contracts going on with the government. You know, we know that money pit after money pit after money pit, and it's just going to be a huge waste of money.
I just think it's strange that a government would push forward a policy without understanding that it's really a vulnerable situation to put our data in.
It's not strange, Helen.
They do it all the time.
It's consistent idiocy.
Still the same problem, and it doesn't matter which party's in. And that's the point that I maybe want to make, is that we spoke about how the Conservatives knew nothing, their digital side was weak. We're still seeing the same problem with these policies that have money invested in them, and they haven't even looked to see if the cybersecurity is an issue. That should be the first thing you check. Is this something that we can do securely? No? Right, forget it then.
There's already, I think, 5 different unique identifiers that are in common use. Got a national insurance number. Most people have a telephone number. And just by, you know, sort of statistical intersection, if you haven't got one of those, then you kind of don't have an identity. The idea of creating some other new thing is just
stupid. Well, we all do have an identity now online. I don't know if you've encountered it yet, but you get given a certain number when you apply for benefits, your pension. When we do our tax, it's the same gateway, and it's the same one for probate.
Government gateway.
Government gateway. That's another one.
There you go. There's another one. So
we don't need anything else. Like, surely you just put the NHS record straight on the gateway record. Job done. We don't need to sell it to external American companies. Come on.
Yeah, it's corrupt. What the bloody hell are they in that? You know, the whole thing will end up getting shot down. And it's the huge squandering of money that pisses me off.
I know. Such a waste. But yeah, they were going to basically, the UK state would have got paid every single time someone did a check on you. So landlord would be making them quite a lot of money because every year they'd do a check on tenants and every landlord across the country. And it's really shit because the people I think that would suffer the most seem to be the people who are renting, the people who need to change jobs quite regularly. So again, the rich people, they're never going to get their digital ID checked. But poorer people definitely will and have their data completely sold to everybody.
Yeah, all sorts of papers, please. Techno-fascism hurts the poor. In a way, it's designed to. I think that it's a way of abusing and class rules, if you like.
Built into the system accidentally.
No, very deliberately.
What, you think it's on purpose? Okay. The House of Lords will vote on something that's going to piss them off. So they'll just go, can't we just do it to the working class?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that the attitude that's there, even if it's not overtly sort of spoken, it's just in the background, you know. It's playing the white man, isn't it, as they say. It's like, let's make life difficult for these hoi polloi.
I also asked Amanda's team if we have permission to film the event. So we'll be able to film the whole event so that we can then stream it out as well, which will advertise Amanda to the world.
Sure, she's very happy about that, and I'm happy. Quid pro quo.
She's actually a good MP. It's rare that you get one.
Our Tom Hayes guy, you know, he's another.
I've heard quite a bit about him actually as well. He's in the news lately.
He seems to be a good egg, working pretty hard. And he's so available, right? You can call him, you can talk to him, you can drop in in his little office that he's got in Boscombe. And he goes around to everyone's houses. He's just like, oh, it's Tommy. He's like a sort of like Billy No Mates homeless guy who goes around knocking on people's doors. He's like, oh, Tommy, can I come in? You want a cup of tea?
But that's what it should be like. You should feel like you can contact your MP if you're required to do so. That's a good thing. And you know what? When you've got a Conservative MP, you don't even know where the office is, let alone how to contact them. They're never in their office anyway. They're always out doing something with their posh mates on the golf course.
Yes, hello. I've been getting obscene phone calls and I want to know what can be done about it.
But yeah, we could do with a proper hour-long documentary on how bad mobile phones are. And we need more and more of those. So there's almost a collection of documentaries on each subject that are civil cybersecurity aimed. That would be ideal.
Things like that, not only do they take time, they take budget as well. And you need other people's help with them. And you can't motivate them to give you help unless you've got money, you know.
And but the British Film Council, they have money.
Well, it's always nice to know that there might be potential sponsors. And I would put in work to approach them and stuff like that. But, you know, if you haven't got some money to spend on people to help you with your projects, then you're really limited. And a documentary that covered that would be really, really cool.
Yeah.
And also to address the monopoly problem.
We could do it. We could do it, right? We're talking about it. So we do a long conversation about the dangers of mobile phone use. And we should feature some kids again.
I found a lovely venue, a nice place to film. It's a converted double-decker bus.
That's awesome.
The magic bus. And upstairs, it's like a kind of weird tour bus with these 1950s American diner style.
That would be an amazing place to film, and we can advertise the company as well, obviously.
So that when we do the event, then we've got something we can say, oh, you can go and watch this. And it's a bit of a leaflet.
A whole planned, like when we do the long planned ones where we've got all of the facts that we want to give out, and we have all the sections that we want to move to, and we know the guests and stuff, and we show up and we do. I think we need to do something like that. That'd be good.
So Threat Locker went down the drain. What the hell happened with Threat Locker?
Huge amount of wasted effort.
They didn't want to deal with us anymore. We're too punk for them.
What's the matter? Too spicy for ya!
They got cold feet. After a year and a half of them leading us on and promising sponsorship and squeezing, what, 3 episodes out of us?
In the end, they
delivered nothing.
No. But that sort of shitty loyalty is going to bite them in the ass. The other guys that I met that were also getting sponsored by Threat Locker, they are not working with them anymore either. So I think Threat Locker have probably pulled back from working with a lot of podcasts because we're too opinionated. That's America, isn't it? Getting more and more white over there, that's for sure.
Threat Locker got Trumpified. It was a lot of wasted effort.
Yeah, look.
Though at times it may feel like the sky is falling around you, never give up. For every day is a new day.